There are giants among us, passing largely unnoticed, intent on carrying out a secret plan to enslave all humanity. They may not look like giants today, but their bloodlines extend all the way back to the Nephilim, the offspring of angels who mated with human women, described in Genesis 6, when giants roamed the land. Stay tuned for my second interview with Gary Wayne, author of the Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humanity, in this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. You may subscribe to the program on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can listen to every episode on our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. We had a great conversation last time, Gary and myself, but I got to tell you, it barely scratched the surface of Gary's research, and so we decided that a second interview was necessary to really flesh out a lot of this stuff. So I'm very, very pleased and blessed to welcome Gary Wayne back to Soaring Eagle Radio. Welcome, Gary.
Oh, so happy to be back and to continue our conversation. I just felt like we were getting kind of warmed up the last time, so
yes.
Pretty eager to get back at it.
That's a good way to describe it. Just getting warmed up. That's exactly right. Well, let me recap, Gary, for our listeners, what we discussed last time. We talked about mythologies and how they are supportive of the biblical narrative. They don't disprove, but in actuality, they actually prove in a good many instances. We discussed Genesis 6 and the Watchers and that whole so-called conspiracy. I don't think it's a conspiracy in the way that people believe that it is. I think that the Bible says exactly what it says and means what it means, and so these watchers left their habitation and engaged in sex with women on the earth. So we chatted about that. We chatted about how this mating led to the birth of the Nephilim, and through them the Anunnaki, the Titans of old, the Gibberim, and so on and so forth. We talked about how those became the demigods of mythology. We talked about an Enoch that doesn't get a lot of press, if you will, and that is the evil son of Cain. We talked about how Hollywood contributes to this through the portrayal of superheroes and so on and so forth. And as you said, Gary, that was a very, very interesting conversation. So I encourage our listeners to go back. If you haven't listened to episode one yet of my conversation with Gary, you need to do that. Listen to part one and the discussion on those topics. So, Gary, I thought we would pick up this time with chapter 47 of your book, where you talk about the disciples of light. And this is a story of how the Freemasons and their subsequent offshoots pervert the biblical account in an attempt to make Lucifer out to be the biblical God. And by the way, that effort continues today, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does, and it's absolutely key to the core levels of conspiracy and deception that they're trying to do. So, you know, when people, I think when they review where we are today and, you know, how far we are from the end time, and I know people have varying understanding of how close, but, you know, we are, or how far away we are from the end time, they have trouble visualizing how all of this can come about, because it's like a world that's turned inside out and upside down. Well, that's exactly what they're preparing.
Yes.
And so when you kind of want to underline that point, when you say that they're trying to use Lucifer to be like an anti-god, as a replacement god, and or to be the god, and then by virtue of that, if you flip that coin over, that means they're trying to make our God of the Bible the evil God and the satanic God, or the Seth of the Egyptian religion. And that is exactly what they're attempting to do. And it is their belief system that inside the secret societies and inside of the Gnostic religions, that the God of the Bible is the evil God, and that the priests and the people who follow Judaism and then Christianity after that have slandered this good God, as they call him, forever, and that he has been miscast as this evil Satan-like character, and they like to call him Lucifer as opposed to Satan. And for people who may not be aware where that name Lucifer comes from, there's just a quick history, because I think it's important, is that it first shows up in the Vulgate Bible by Jerome, because he doesn't know how to translate, and most people don't, this word Hell, H-E-Y-L-E-L. And so it sort of goes with Venus, and he plugs in the Latin word for Venus, which is Lucifer, instead of morning star or day star, as most other translations would translate it. And that also goes over in Isaiah 14 to the King James Bible. So they like to look at him as a being of light. And as you noted, the chapter title is called The Disciples of Light. So this is the angel that is leading the disciples of light. And as we know in the Bible, Satan is called an angel who masquerades as an angel of light.
Yes.
And so this is perfect sort of symmetry between Bible prophecy as to what's going to happen and what they are doing. And so Lucifer is the good God of the Freemasons and the Gnostics. He's the one that they believe brings knowledge and wisdom and brings light to the world. He is the one who protects them from God. He is the one that is going to help humanity free themselves from God. Understand, this is their belief system, not my belief system. I'm just
yes.
sort of jumping in into their shoes and telling you how they view it. And they view that Lucifer is the equal of God.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And if you understand that now brings you to the point of maybe understanding why people think that this is a good religion or a belief system and a good cause if they've been deceived and brainwashed. And as they go through the initiations and the several degrees, that's actually brainwashing into a Luciferian doctrine and at the adept level, where they take Lucifer as their God. And so this is what they believe. And I know that the angels know they can't defeat God. And I know probably the demons know they can't defeat God. But what they bring down through these various polytheist religions and how they get them excited and loyal is they lie to them and say, I am the equal of God, Lucifer. We have the ability to, if we can't defeat them, to at least receive a realm of our own that we can live separate, and Lucifer will be the God. But the angels know they can't win. They're just out to deceive
yes.
and destroy as many humans as possible, and if totally successful, to totally have humanity rebel, which, of course, through Judaism and Christianity, that, you know, there are people that are that have overcome and will overcome, and that humanity won't be driven into the abyss, but they're out to destroy as many as possible. And certainly after the resurrection, when Jesus went to the spirits that were in the abyss and to the fallen angels and reminded them that their conspiracy or their war was almost over and their fate was sealed, just as it says in Revelation in the lake of fire, because the resurrection overcomes their rebellion, and humans will be raised above angels in the future world. But in the meantime, these groups are brainwashing people, and they are preparing to bring on the end time because they want this rendezvous. That's part of the deception. And so everything has to be turned inside out to make this happen. And so they believe that they call themselves the disciples of light, the children of light, the sons of light. And so any group that you run across with, and I know this could be said about Christianity as well, but I'm talking about the polytheist organizations, understand they truly believe that, and that they're following the God of light, which they call Lucifer. And so like the sons of righteousness, the sons of light, the Essenes would be a group around the time of Jesus that, you know, are very polytheistic and are some of the roots of these modern organizations. The Children of Light is what they like to call themselves in Freemasonry and the secret societies. And they're also encouraged to walk towards the light in those religions and societies where Lucifer is, right? Yeah. They're encouraged to come in under the angel of light and follow him. Yes. So the imagery is quite significant, and it underlines the concept that we're talking about. It will be turned inside and out. And this is the new age of Aquarius, new age of Atlantis, the new age of light that they want to bring on in their false millennium. And that anybody who disagrees with them will be evil, mundane, intolerant, and not worthy of evolving to Godhood.
Yes. Yeah. And we see that today, Gary, and one of the things that struck me as you were explaining this and their penchant for describing themselves as disciples of light is that is a very similar strategy that Richard Dawkins and other well-known published atheists have used. They've adopted the moniker of being brights. We are brights. We are light.
Yes.
To this culture. And I'm wondering, yep. is there a connection?
Oh, absolutely, because the sciences pay homage to their roots. Mm. And their roots go back to the seven sacred sciences that Enoch the Evil perverted and has been promoted by secret societies all the way through. And interesting enough, if you go back to the 1600s, and Francis Bacon is the inspirational founder to this society, but there is a group that is to set up, along with other ones, but the Royal Society is probably the last one to be set up, or second last one to be set up after the fall of the Knights Templar. And so the Royal Society is organized by Rosicrucians and Freemasons, and it's organized in the same spirit as the seven sacred sciences of prehistory and the time of Nimrod, and all the way throughout history, was set up. It was designed to do a number of things. One is to develop the science. So all science reports to them. The second thing was to take education away from the Roman Church and to brainwash people through the education systems into Luciferian doctrines. And that's where science really comes in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the other parts of science was to create buildings and monuments to honor Lucifer and the fallen pantheon, which they're very, very good at, and to lead people away from God and to deceive them away from God and into honoring the religion of Lucifer and the followers of Lucifer and the pantheon. So they've done exactly what was being done in the past, and I think they've been very, very successful, because if you look at science, it does not work in an objective scenario. It works in a very narrow vacuum of a preconceived agenda, and no outside idea can be inserted into its predetermined conclusion, or certainly anything that has to do with God creating the earth can't be at this point, right? Everything's
yes,
got to be
right.
designed to lead people away from God, because that is the religion of science and the religion of the Royal Society. And what they're trying to do as they're doing this is utilize all sort of aspects to prepare people for this deception that's coming and for the end time and the doctrines of the end times. Because once you have control of that sort of ideology and control of the schools, now you can bring in globalist doctrines, and you can bring in environmental doctrines, and you can bring in scare tactic doctrines that are all sort of transcendent of national borders to start preparing people for the end time. And one other thing that people don't know is that evolution, even though everybody thinks that's a secular idea, that comes out of Eastern mysticism, actually. And I'm trying to think of our friend who created evolution.
Darwin.
Darwin, yes. I was going to say Dawkins, but yeah. Darwin. Yeah. I mean, he was a Eastern mystic. He was into Eastern religions, and he adopted this idea of this evolving spirit of their belief system into gods over time, right?
Yes.
So they'll come out, they'll release the evolution doctrine when they're ready. But in the meantime,
yes, right.
It well serves their purpose, because it leads people away from God.
That's exactly right. And when you say they, Gary, let's give our listeners a little background. You mentioned the Freemasons. You mentioned the Rosicrucians, but another one of those groups, the Illuminati. All of these, and there are certainly others. But all of these groups are what we would call secret societies. And I know in some places, as soon as you say that phrase, secret societies, you get people rolling their eyes and, you know, thinking, okay, here we go up from outer space. But this is a well-documented historical fact that secret societies not only existed in times past, but they exist today. They have a very clear agenda. You've been describing that, what that agenda is. And of course, it is all of it is Luciferian.
Yeah, and they document their history and
their
plans and their agenda. And, you know, certainly from a historical perspective, to bring it forth, I mean, I found, like, Albert Mackey and, you know, one of the very, very important peoples on history, and Pike, in terms of their philosophy, right? Philosophy comes out of the seven sacred sciences. So,
yes.
And philosophy is an amalgamation of the sciences, and it is the sort of key religious doctrine of universities, right, to teach them philosophy.
That's right.
And the tradition of philosophy was to bring together all of the sciences, you know, coming out of rhetoric and grammar and dialectics, but to harmonize and unite the sciences in one sort of unitarian concept of the polytheist religion. And it was sort of the arbitrator. So they look at philosophy as being superior to all of the seven sciences, because it allows them to create great technology that they're going to unleash, certainly in the olden age, and will, by that development, allow them to bring about the golden age, or the what they call the absolute science. So, and of course, alchemy comes out of that sort of same sort of idea, where philosophy harmonizes other of the sciences, so they create even greater sciences and technology, and so expect that.
Yes, yeah.
I kind of got down on a rabbit trail, but when we talk about that, I mean, these are well documented in their history, and I just want to bring people at a crossroads, and if we get a chance, we might go backwards or we might go forwards later in the show. But in 1307, the Templars were disbanded. This was the sort of the central organization of secret societies coming out of the Middle Ages, but in 1307, it's disbanded. So what they have to do is recreate these organizations and into a number of organizations so they can't be so easily disbanded. Now, for the secret societies, this started to begin in 1188 at the, what they call the Cutting of the Elms, where the original orders that came together to set up the Templars as sort of this veneer organization in umbrellaing other organizations underneath, they have a splitting of the ways. And so they split through the splitting of the elm in a very Gnostic ceremony, religious ceremony. But the people leaving this group set up the Rose Cross at that sort of point in time. And then we start to see them formulating in the 13 and 1400s and creating the Sarcani Rond and Ordo Draconis in Europe to re-put the dragon kingships on the thrones and to continue the pursuits of Thoth or the seven sciences, and which is later called the Invisible College, which is also an alternate name for the Royal Society. And so they start this off with the Rosicrucians in 1188 and are well prepared at 1307 to continue. And then in the 1300s, they start to put together the Freemasonry organization as well. And so the Rosicrucians are focusing on development of the higher sciences, the absolute sciences, continuing the legacy in the religion, and to encourage and organize a whole bunch of these other groups, because you've got a whole bunch of noble bloodlines that are running about half of this organization, and it's fairly high up. And so half of it is the noble and half of it are being risen up from the lower level organizations. Freemasonry was created to specifically work on politics and military organizations and to control that aspect, and then later the media, and to be a preparatory organization for the higher level. So the Rosicrucians are significantly higher than a third degree Freemason, for example, or 33rd degree. And then you have the Illuminati, which also created in about the 1500s, and their job was to destroy Christianity along with the Jesuits and to focus on establishing world government, which was very much a Templar ideal, along with the universal religion that was really the hope for Saint Bernard, who wrote the bull for the Templar organization within Catholicism. And just as Rosicrucians are working to organize the universal religion, so there's a little bit of overlap. And the Jesuits were recreated in the 1500s within the Roman Church to continue the work of the Benedictines and the Augustine. And the Cistercians, which were the Gnostic moles that worked underneath in the Roman Church after the fall of the Templars, because the Templars were that whole overarching organization within the Church. So that had to be replaced, and of course that's why they have control over so many schools and education on the Roman Catholic side, plus their own schools, and also explains why they were front and center on any new exploration in the New World, destroying and manipulating and controlling that information. And also they had to create the banking arm to the Templars, because the Templars were the modern banking arm. And that came out of the Bauer family in the 1700s, and they changed their name to the Rothschilds once they opened up their bank in 1812 in London. And then also the Royal Society that we all talked about. So the Templars had that all housed underneath, and those are the organizations that have been working ever since. And so if you want to kind of go up the secret society scale, you have Freemasonry that is the preparatory organization. So they bring new people and new blood and things into the organization, just as the Bilderberger Group does with new money, or the Bohemian Grove with new money. And at the third degree or the 33rd degree, they become Illuminati. So Illuminati is this sort of central sort of core that controls Freemasonry. And at that level, at the adept level, you are indoctrinated into Luciferian doctrine and told the secrets of the universe that will overturn every preconceived idea, is what they're told. And above that, you have kind of at the equal, you have the Royal Society, and both of the, not the Royal Society, the Jesuits, and then both of those report to the Rosicrucians. And so the Rosicrucians are controlling all of these other ones underneath, because they are kind of the link, as I said, to some higher organizational structure that goes back to the pure bloodlines. And it goes back just sort of quickly, and there's not that many of them of significance, but you have the Rosicrucians, which I said are about 50% purebloods in them, and originally there were 66 founding members of these purebloods, so another interesting number. But they answer to the committee of 300, who answers to the council of 33, who answers to the family of 13. But basically, at the committee of 300 and up, it's all purebloods.
Wow, Gary, you've just explained why the world works the way it does and why we see what we're seeing happening today in about 6 to 7 minutes. That was phenomenal. I appreciate that background.
Well, I thank you. It's such a leviathan that it's hard to explain, you know, in short order, and it has so many different nuances to it.
Yes.
And it has so many reaches into everything, and it is so large and so robust that, as you kind of mentioned earlier, people just kind of say, oh, yeah, aliens, secret societies, you guys are all crazy.
Right, right.
But
yeah, they don't understand the reach and the number, the tentacles that have just wrapped themselves around everything. And they've had centuries to do this.
Yeah. You know, and I know there's going to be people out there that say, well, you know, the Jesuits, you know, okay. I know a lot of people talk against the Jesuits, but they also, a lot of people speak highly of them. But, you know, Jesuits were created by Ignatius of Loyola, and he was a Basque, and I don't know whether people know who Basques are, but I just put a post up on my Facebook line.
Well, yeah, let's chat about that. Go ahead and tell us about that.
Yeah, so on that Facebook line, I'm just connecting who the Basque are, who believe they are the pure line out of Atlantis, who seeded Egyptian civilization and Sumerian civilization and Trojan civilization and Scythian civilization. So the major ones that come up, develop after the flood. And that they used to work with these bloodlines coming back out of the Middle East that they seeded, but have been ostracized out. And I think what they're doing is they're trying to be too dominant to these bloodlines coming up out of the Nephilim out of the Middle East that migrated to Europe and took over the European thrones. So that's who Basques are. And Ignatius was a Basque. So he's Gnostic, and he's got royal and a noble and bloodlines back to these purebloods who, through their elitism, they say they're the most pure. And what's interesting about this as well is that the basis for the organization is to develop the seven sacred sciences, which is, again, one of those things that you have to know as a marker of the other side, is the development of these seven sacred sciences. And they're developing the seven sacred sciences by studying things like Latin and Greek classical literature, philosophy, the science and the arts, and they're divided into a whole bunch of different areas that, you know, that are designed to sort of bring about this left-wing polytheist ideology as it comes together. And that's why liberation theology, you know, people will know as a classic manifestation that comes out of that.
Yes.
And they, in the beginning, were working with the Freemasons, but their agendas are different, and they thought they could work separately, or better separately, and plus the Freemasons were afraid they were going to take over their organization, so they parted probably in around the 1700s. But this is an organization that is not working totally for the Christian agenda, so to speak. And now we have, for the first time, a Jesuit as a pope.
Yes, very interesting.
Yes, and changing doctrine incredibly.
Oh, incredibly, yeah. Well,
And I heard him speaking the other day, I think yesterday, not speaking, but on a news report.
Mm-hmm.
And he was speaking against countries that have life sentences for murderers and saying that's, you know, that's like the death sentence, and was trying to lower that. I mean, he will change doctrine unlike we've ever seen in the Roman Church, to prepare that to become Babylon, in how I understand things, in the end time.
Yes, yes. So when all of these organizations, Gary, when they talk about their goal being to establish or create a new Atlantis, what exactly do they mean by that?
Well, everything that they say and do is important in the language that they're utilizing, or the allegories or the iconology, because these are religions of secrets and allegories, and you need to be initiated to understand these allegories. So when they use a word like Atlantis, you know it's significant. And so the leader, the inspirational founder to the Royal Society was Francis Bacon, who was a Rosicrucian. And he wrote a book called The New Atlantis. And in The New Atlantis, it's about setting up a world government that is dominated by a universal religion that works with the sciences. Right? Which is what the Royal Society has been developing.
You know, right? I don't mean to interrupt you here, Gary, but I got to tell you, that sounds a lot like technocracy to me, where the social scientists, the engineers of the world, they establish a global government because they're the experts.
Yes, and they all are initiatory, right?
Yes,
whether or not
that's
it's
right.
Doctors or engineers, they're all, and again, anything that has initiation is polytheist.
Yes, yes.
And it's the other side. So,
that's right.
Again, one of those markers. Now, why choose Atlantis, right? Well, because you have to understand just what I was saying is, not only do the Basques believe they go back to Atlantis and prehistory, but Atlantis to them, whether it's an allegory of a different civilization or that's the actual name, and certainly Plato wrote about it, is heavily rooted in their belief system, just as the Nazis took their belief system back to Atlantis, only they called it Thule. And again, the same belief system and same ideology. But where I'm going with this is, if you look into all of the accounts of Atlantis, you will find that it was considered the helm of world government in the Golden Age.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And it was checked, according to Plato, by the Athenians before it was able to conquer the whole world, but it was still considered the helm of world government. And it wasn't just this island in the Atlantic. It was part of it, and that's where it was centered. But Poseidon had five sets of twins with Clymene, and/or Titans and/or Nephilim. So again, understand how all of this comes together.
Yes.
Now, these ten kings were part of this ten-king empire that was the helm of the antediluvian world government.
Ten.
Yeah, this is what they're trying to create, is the new Atlantis, just as we understand in Revelation and in Daniel that the end time will be composed of, you know, and your audience is well aware of this, of a ten-king empire, which is the world government of the end time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's move in to this consideration another organization that's quite high up and, again, wrote and are certainly fairly strong in their bloodlines, but certainly well-initiated above the third or 33rd degree. So they're working alongside as a special project with the Rosicrucians, answering to the Rosicrucians. They're called the Club of Rome. They were formed in the late 60s and early 70s as they got going. And their job is to bring about world government specifically in a specific structure. And that structure is 10 groups of nations and or trading blocks and or spheres of influence, however you want to call them, that will form this world government. That's their specific goal. And they introduce doctrines through their other organizations and ideology and control of the media to cattle herd people into world government to bring those borders.
Yes. Wow.
In the beginning, they were the start of the environmental movement. They first tabled the global warming when everybody was telling us we were going into an ice age at that time, overpopulation, peak oil, and that we're going to destroy ourselves from the planet. And to come together as under one people, as one religion, is what they're planning, which is exactly the Babel allegory that God stop from happening within 100 years after the flood.
Boy, when you recognize the scope of this, Gary, and the power and the influence that these organizations have over the entire earth, you just mentioned some things that they issued as really strategies to, I think you said, herd people into a certain perspective, talking about the environmental movement being one, and then that leads the way to sustainability, and they get the United Nations involved as maybe as the front man. I don't know. But talking about all these things, it places people really under bondage, doesn't it?
It does. That's the idea, is to enslave people. And, you know, again, you can take a page out of some obvious information that they're putting out there, the Georgia Guidestones,
yes,
where they want to bring the population down to 500 million.
Yes.
So when I use the word cattle herd us into this, understand that these bloodlines, they believe that humans outside those bloodlines are like cattle.
Yes.
And that when they talk about overpopulation, they want to get rid of us en masse and mm-hmm. only have a population of whatever level of pure blood or DNA markers that are required for this new age or this new age of Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
So they are out all the time, front and center, with what their agenda is, who they are, and what they're trying to do. But they know that people don't understand what they're trying to do. And if they get a whiff of it, then most people say, no, that's too crazy. And there's only, you know, some stalwarts out there that keep saying, watch what they're doing, because they're all left-wing.
Yes.
They're all anti-God.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to do universal religion, and they're all trying to do universal government. It is an amazing consistency of message.
Yes, yes. They all support eugenics, abortion,
yes,
euthanasia, doctor-assisted suicide, and anything that has to do with death, they all support it. That should be a red flag right there.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you look at abortion and child sacrifice. That was a classic sin of the Nephilim in the secret societies before the flood.
That's right. Yeah.
Part of the horrible things taught to the people, the descendants of Cain and the Nephilim, by the fallen angels. Again, when you talk about how far this goes back, it is, and it's exactly the same rituals and belief system, because even the secret societies today drink blood in their higher level rituals.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of speculation as to what other horrible things that they did that we would recognize from those ancient religions. And, you know, I'll probably leave that to the audience imagination, because it's pretty gruesome.
Yes.
And blood drinking was a notorious trait of the Nephilim.
Well, that's very interesting you mentioned that, because a lot of these WikiLeaks that we're now being made aware of contain a lot of occult practices that are being engaged in by our government officials. It's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you look at how the politicians are being fed, they're Freemasons,
mm-hmm.
and they're coming out of the skull and bones into the CFR, and
yes,
they're all working in the same direction. And you can pretty much take most of the people at the UN, they're all occultists, right?
Yes,
I mean,
that's
they're
right. Yes.
All working in the same polytheist idea. And that's why if you're anything to do with Christianity and Judaism kind of coming out of the United Nations and increasingly out of our national government,
mm-hmm.
is distinctly anti-Christian and anti-Jewish in terms of
yes.
our belief system.
Yes.
Unless, of course, we cross over and then we take up their beliefs, then all of a sudden we're the greatest, most enlightened people they ever met.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Progressive Marxists, leftist Christians. And I know that's oxymoronic for our listeners, but if you're a progressive Marxist, liberal leftist Christian, then you're okay.
Yeah, well, exactly. And progressivism, you know, it went underground for many years, and it was only in the last 15 years or so that that term has been acceptable.
Right.
I mean, it was the Western offshoot of
that's right.
Nazism, National Socialism.
Yes.
And people say anytime you try and connect that, it's just because of the brainwashing that they've done so that you don't try and connect them, right?
Right.
That's and people say, well, National Socialism was a right-wing ideology. No.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. The only thing it's right of is socialism, communism, and anarchism. And again, they have anarchists labeled as right-wing people today.
Yes.
And again, you look at the skinheads and stuff and the Nazis that are around here. I mean, they're still initiatory society, right?
Yes.
And anything and the KKK was initiatory and has all the same iconologies and symbolisms, you know, from dragons and realms and all the different things that they have in occultism. These are groups. They're just out there to deceive people. But progressives are National Socialists.
Yes, that's right.
There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And they want an organized, they want a world that's set up with oligarchies controlling most of the free flow of business.
Yes.
Working towards the agenda of the central government. And that's National Socialism.
That's the whole point in the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all these other trade acts is to create exactly what you just said, an oligarchy.
Absolutely. And they continue to, and even, you know, I know Hillary Clinton is saying she's not going to sign it. She'll sign it. I don't know whether people know the history of NAFTA.
Right.
Well, at the time of that signing, you had Bill Clinton running for presidency, and you had Chrétien as the Prime Minister of Canada running, and they both ran against NAFTA. What was the first bill both leaders of both countries signed after with NAFTA?
Wow. Yeah, my memory failed me there. I knew it was passed under Clinton, but I did not recall that he actually ran against that. Wow.
Yep. Yeah, so they put in a couple small little changes and said, we fixed it.
We fixed it, yeah. Yeah, you fixed us is what you did.
So
they are
about setting up these trading blocks, and again, because as the end time is coming up out of the old Roman Empire as we understand it in prophecy, free trade was part of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. Free trade was part of all of these large empires who conquered all of these different countries mm-hmm. of the past. Depending on which empire you want to talk about, it doesn't really matter. But Greek, Persian, they all had a free flow of goods through those empires. And so we're going to have that again in the end time.
Yes, as long as they were being taxed at the appropriate level and the appropriate people were receiving those that revenue, it was free trade.
Absolutely. And look for Babylon to take a tribute on every transaction that's made, like a value-added tax, or in Canada, as we call it, like a general goods and services tax. So every transaction that will happen, the end time religion will take a small piece of that as a tribute. And that's how it becomes so wealthy. And that's how you see the fulfillment of Babylon and the end time as being opulent, and why the merchants weep and mourn for her when the Antichrist and the ten kings from the empires destroy her at about midpoint of the last 7 years.
Yeah. Folks, I hope that you are appreciating this very broad and sweeping conversation, because Gary is really outlining for us the history of how we arrived at today. The things that we're seeing from our government that are beyond head scratchers. They're just absolutely astounding, the things that are going on today, both in Canada and in America. And Gary's just painted a very, very good picture of that. Gary, I wonder if we can move on now and jump into another subject and really bore down here. In your book, Section 4, The Terminal Generation, subtitled The Time of Jacob's Trouble, you talk about a time that I think is right on our doorstep, a time that's rapidly approaching, and that's Jacob's trouble. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, we read this: what has been will be again, what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was already long ago. It was here before our time. How does all of that, what we've talked about so far, how does that tie in to your research and in writing in this specific section in your book that you've titled The Terminal Generation?
You know, when I was putting the book together, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do from the ancient aspects that I was talking about and how was I going to bridge it to the end time.
Yeah.
And so Section 4 was designed to do that. And so Section 4 is about bridging the old into prophecy and what's going to happen. And I lead that off, and I love that quote, because chapter 39, which is the first chapter of section 4, is entitled Nothing New Under the Sun.
That's right. Yep.
And so it perfectly lays down what we're talking about, what I'm trying to do. And so I'm trying to convince people that to understand what's going to happen, you have to go back into prehistory. And shortly after the flood, because again, I always go to as one of the first things of my doctrine of research and understanding my faith is I go to what Jesus says on everything first.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then I put everything else around that, not yeah. the other way around.
Yeah.
And I also try and look at all different verses and passages so that, not selectively picking, so it sort of goes to your preconceived conclusion at times.
Right, right.
And you got to go where the information is,
That's
not
right.
what you'd like it to, like
That's
it
right.
to be.
Yep.
And so Jesus said that his second coming and the sign, one of the signs of the end time would be like the days of Noah. And so if that's what Jesus took the time to point out to us, then perhaps we better learn about the times of Noah, which, of course, we know from Enoch that the Nephilim were created in his generation, in the sixth generation, the generation of Jared.
Yeah.
But Noah was alive then, too.
That's right.
In that generation.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
he lived to be 950 years old. And he also lived, you know, I think 350 years after the flood.
Right.
So when we're talking about the times of Noah, that includes Sodom and Gomorrah. That includes Babel.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the things that were happening up to that point in time, and that's why Nimrod and Babel is so important. And to understand, like Sodom and Gomorrah is, you know, was destroyed because in the polytheist belief system, and we can't say this biblically, all we have is the consequences, is that those were cities of light to polytheists and a place where Nephilim were. And so they look at Sodom and Gomorrah completely different, and one of the evil things that God did to the world, because he's the evil God, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we need to understand these things from where they come from and what they're talking about. And certainly Babel is a end time allegory for us, because you have an antichrist-like figure, Nimrod, and you have a universal religion that's Babel, which is Babylon, which is this polytheism of Enochian mysticism that comes out of the seven sacred sciences, that is probably going to be this religion of the end time, larger than Islam, as is what most people, because it's more the thing of the day that people are trying to put us, in my opinion, put a square peg into a round hole. I think this universal religion tames Islam and brings it in under the fold.
Yeah.
Just as they're trying to do with Christianity.
Yes, yeah, I would agree with that.
So that's why understanding the past allows you to understand the language of the secret societies and the allegories and what things are going to look like in the end time. And then it's a lot easier to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And so I talk about things like the technology that was in the Antediluvian epoch, where I believe it was greater than what we have today, that came out of these secret societies and the seven sacred sciences and the mystical religion, and which was found and reinstated at Babel, which is why we have that odd language of God saying one language, one people, nothing's going to be prevented from them. And we see them building another ziggurat there. So, so all of this is in place. So the technology has to be astounding, right?
Yes.
And we have to have not we have to have more than just violence going on. We have to have a corruption, and I think it's a corruption of the entire world, just like what it was in the antediluvian epoch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, corruption of plants and the biological world, and corruption of beings and on a mass scale. So that requires more than some sort of sexual copulation from the angelic realm. It requires, you know, changing things at the DNA level.
That's right.
And I believe that was going on in the antediluvian epoch. And then we have the Atlantean scenario, and we have the Nephilim. So somehow Nephilim are going to be part of the end time.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Whether or not it's the descendants, or it is another copulation, or another form of Nephilim concept trying to be redone, whether it's transhumanism or genetics, like the eugenics, like the Nazis were trying to do, to create the new man, which is the superhero, which is the Nephilim, that's the concept, whether it's bionics, whether it's through cloning, so that somehow they can avatar a spirit into these bodies and create some sort of immortality as a promise, perhaps to take the mark. But we have to have this Nephilim concept, in my understanding, be prevalent. And again, a lot of people will use King James to look version for specific language on these empires that were throughout history in the book of Daniel, and those are the seed of these empires. So that means that this is coming out of those descendants, because the Nephilim had their descendants in all these royal families, right?
Yes.
So the ten kings probably either have to be real Nephilim or descendants of Nephilim. And we also have the possibility of what happens after the abyss, when that's released, and do those impassioned angels that were locked up in there, do they recreate Nephilim at that point in time? We don't know. And certainly Revelation and the New Testament don't talk about giants, but we know the days have to be like Noah. So I kind of lean more towards the descendants of the giants that are playing the larger role.
Yeah, yeah, with the bloodlines and the royalty. Gary, I wonder what your view is. One of the things I've noticed in the past 10, 15 years is this growing infatuation that people have with the supernatural. And it's become common fare in movies and television and books and you name it. People are just curious about the supernatural. And I wonder, is this leading, because we touched on evolution earlier in our conversation, and I think this might be a good place to loop back with that and tie this together. Is it possible, in your view, that this increased interest in the supernatural and the mystical element of evolution that's still developing, could those things be melded together in a way where people would be convinced to accept alien life forms and UFOs and this idea that life here was seeded, that those are our real creators? Is that possible?
Yeah, and let me try and pull a few pieces here together to make those comments a little bit more real for people.
Okay.
Because yes, the answer is yes. So the question is how are they going to do that?
Yes, right.
Right. So the first thing is let's go back to their belief system, and that when we talked about the bloodlines, and a lot of people believe those are the Rh negative bloodline, that this is the real concept of the Rosicrucians and the real concept that the Nazis picked up on, that within this blood it has the ability to recreate the ancient Nephilim, which is what Hitler was trying to do through eugenics, and try and create this super Aryan race.
Yes.
And that means demigods, right?
Yes,
so that's
right.
An evolution physically and spiritually in their belief system.
Yes.
To rise up. Now, another word that they like to use in their belief system that describes this from a spiritual concept is called the gene of Isis.
Mm.
And the gene of Isis, they also say, is the root word for Genesis.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So, I mean, they like to
very tricky.
Draft Yeah. Very tricky. They're very good at these types of things. And this gene of Isis is said to be one of the markers in their genes that also takes them back to the fallen angels and the Nephilim. Okay? This is also known, and this will come out through the New Age and Theosophical movement and the Eastern movements, as the spark of the divine. Okay? So this is all the same allegory. And now I'm going to tie that back in politically. I'll bring in the aliens and technology here down the road. When you hear New World Order speeches and President Bush Sr. And also his son Jr. use this term in a few of their speeches, and most people will be familiar with it when I mention it, but he talked about 1,000 points of light.
Yes, that's right.
That's what he's talking about, is a spark of this divine, the gene of Isis. The spiritual aspect that is the descendant, that's the spark from the fallen angels that is superior to humans, that when they bring together a world government, that the spark will be united and they'll have this harmonic convergence and they will evolve or vibrate to a higher level.
Oh, man.
Okay? When you think about that aspect, now you say, okay, what else is involved here? Is you have this alien aspect that, hey, you know, you have the ancient aliens and, you know, they're the gods and that sort of mythos. And that they've been manipulating our DNA to help us evolve, to catch up or to become gods. And again, it very quickly moves away from secular to just another religion, right? And the fallen angel just aren't quite as godlike in the ancient alien mythos. But tying that back together, though, is that when you look at anything that's in science fiction that they use to prepare us for, and I don't care whether it's Babylon 5 or Star Trek or Star Wars, you have this occultist religion.
Yes.
It's Eastern mysticism, it's Gnosticism, it's the same religion. It's Enochian mysticism.
Yeah.
Okay? That's a clear marker. And any time in science fiction where we understand that we're no longer the single type of advanced being in the universe, we suddenly rush together and form a world government.
Yes, right.
Right?
Yep.
So that's also out of fear as well, too, so that we won't be wiped from the face of the earth.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
So if we understand that this alien deception can be used to fast track the final parts of universal religion and government, because they're going to bring that mystical religion with them as part of this unveiling of the aliens, then you have things coming together that make a lot of sense, and also some prophetic statements where you have war in heaven in Revelation 12 with Michael and the saints throwing the angels down to the earth. That's at the midpoint of the tribulation, at the time of the abomination, just afterwards. And you also have discussions and prophecy of Daniel raising his throne into, or not Daniel, the Antichrist, raising his throne into reaching heaven, and also being able to do damage to some of the starry hosts. So I think you could also connect that back in and say, hey, this is going to be like we're fighting in Star Wars for our freedom. Right?
Mm-hmm.
God and the angels are cast in this allegory as the Darth Vader and the evil empire that you're fighting for your freedom from.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you've got these dualistic forces where good and evil, you can't overthrow one or the other if they're always in balance. Again, that comes back to the ideology and doctrine of Lucifer and God being equal.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, if you get into what might make this a little bit more real, is if you, let's say you look at Lord of the Rings and you see these little people that are in there. You have the elves and the hobbits and a couple other types of little people. That's part of their belief system, that there was more corruption that went on in the antediluvian epoch and created lots of other beings. Of course, in that epoch you have other strange creations, monsters like cyclops and centaurs and what have you. But where I'm going with this is fairy mythology is very much related to the Gnostic religion coming out of the Cathars and the Elven bloodlines and the fairy godmothers and things like that.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, and where I'm going with that is fairy mythology has more than one aspect to it. So there's four different classifications of fairies. And the first one is led by the proud angel who led a rebellion against the god of the universe and was fighting for their own realm. And they come to the earth and they create the second class of fairies, which is the earthborn fairies. And you might know that of the Tuatha De Danann in particular, which was also part of the Atlantean Empire. And then you have the daemons or the demons, which is the bodiless spirits of the earthborn fairies because their bodies died, as we talked about in the last show. And then you have another interesting class that's called the elementals. And in the elementals, you have three other subcategories, and they all have a whole bunch of other subcategories as well. And so you have gnomes, and you have leprechauns, and then you have the little people. And the little people are the pretty ones, the leprechauns are the mischievous ones, and the gnomes are the ugly ones, and they were in charge of genealogies and knowledge and protecting it, and they worked alongside of the Nephilim kings. Just as you also had a wizard or a priest of that religion also working with all of the Nephilim kings in prehistory and Egyptian religions going down in the Mesopotamian kingships. Now, what's interesting is in this gnome classification of these ugly ones, there is one class that has flying machines, great knowledge, kidnaps people, flies out of portals in the water and or fairy shays or fairy mounds, and they kidnap people, and they're known as the gray fairies or the little grays, or the gray neighbors, as they're called in Scotland. And I put one of those fairy abductions in the book in this section. We're talking about section 4.
Yeah.
So I introduced the alien sort of idea. And if you didn't know I was describing a fairy abduction, you would say I was describing an abduction by gray aliens.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So my point is that this has been going on a long time, right? But it marriages with the alien mythos, with all everything else coming together to deceive people that we're just one of many in the universe, and it's part of the end time deception.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right.
So hopefully I was able to make that clear enough, because that's a lot of pieces.
You did very well, Gary. I appreciate that. Now, I think it's clear that the days that we're living in, we are living in the days that are described in the Book of Revelation. Mystery Babylon, as a one-world religion, is certainly being constructed right in front of our eyes.
And, as we speak, yes.
Yes, as we speak. And I would tend to agree with you and your outlook on that all of the world's religions are going to be brought under this one banner. And that includes... folks, that includes Christianity. I've made the argument for a long time that the visible organized church is not true Christianity, that there is a remnant within this visible body that are true believers. And I think that fact is borne out by what we're seeing in so many churches and the apostasy that they're given over to. And the economic piece of it, Gary, that we see going on now lends itself very well to an economic Babylon that Revelation
yes.
Talks about. So I think we're right there. What do you
yep.
think?
Oh, we're getting close. You know, we're not in the last 7 years by any stretch of the imagination,
right.
But I think it's on the horizon, and there's a lot of pieces to be pulled together. I mean, world government and world religion are large stumbling blocks, just as the Jewish people being able to do their sacrifice for the first 3.5 years of the last 7. But I also think that there's a lot of information out there today that they take the information out of the book of Josephus that the temple isn't located on the dome of the mosque, and it's just off to the side on the ridge of the Rock of Zion there.
Yes.
It goes down into the valley. And so that's a possibility for that, and or there'll be an exception under this universal religion for them to do it on a wing on the temple as what Daniel talks about.
Yes.
But I do believe prophecy is also fulfilled in ways that people don't see coming, and it's a bit of a surprise.
Yes.
And so cataclysm is also part of that. So you can have things like an alien encounter that they reveal themselves, or you can have a nuclear war, or you could have apocalyptic diseases, or you could have environmental catastrophes. You could have a number of different things that could drive people very quickly in this direction.
Yes, that's right. Folks, the book is The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. It is a masterpiece of research, and I mentioned this the last time, but you won't find a more thoroughly documented, researched, footnoted with all of the links where you can go and find this information for yourself on this subject. It is magnificently done, Gary, and I applaud you and all the work that it took to do this. And that's available, by the way, on Gary's website. That's Genesis and the number 6, Genesis6Conspiracy.com. Again, Genesis, the number 6, Conspiracy.com. I encourage you to go get the book, but make sure you set aside a lot of time because you're not going to finish this in a day or two. It's that good. Gary, any new projects you're working on you want to share with our listeners?
Well, still actively promoting this book very hard and trying to make time to write for my second book. So I do plan to publish. I think it's a long ways off, and I have a lot of work to do on it, but it will be in a different area than what this book is. It's about the Holy Covenant and the Lost Tribes and how Israel and Judah, what their role is in end time prophecy. Mm-hmm. And it'll have a little bit of Nephilim stuff in the beginning only because that's where it begins. So.
Yes. Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I can't wait to get my hands on that and do some reading. And, of course, we'll have to chat about that. Gary, I appreciate you being on the show with me again. And I think there may even be a third show that we could talk about.
I would love to do another one because
we're about,
coming up to about halfway point.
That's
the book.
That's what I was going to say. We made it about halfway, so we'll do another one and we'll get that lined up. And I'm sure listeners will appreciate that very much. I appreciate you being on with me again, Gary. God bless you.
Very much appreciated being here, and hopefully we talked about a few things that are going to raise some curiosity with the audience and. Perhaps have them dig a little bit deeper into it, because that's what this is all about.
Yes, that's right. Amen. Amen. God bless you and take care.
God bless you, and you take care as well.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and, of course, follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. You can visit them on the Internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio Program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek Him.